We start with the traditions of the Brahmachari in the Gurukul, what things he would do, eat, not eat. Okay.
You know what? Go out and ask Gordon and Ryan to come. He's in the pump.
But a student who resides with his teacher must observe the following restrictive rules, duly controlling all his organs in order to increase his spiritual merit. So it means by following discipline, by following restrictions, then one is able to gain spiritually. Because it mentions here spiritual merit. Means that one can gain academic prowess even without any culture. I mean, it's not uncommon that you'll find many academics, they're very intelligent but not necessarily very cultured. It means they know how to deal in the circles they have to deal, but they as individuals may not be very cultured or very controlled in their senses or anything like that. So the point being made here is that if one wants to develop spiritually, one must be able to control the senses and follow a lifestyle that restricts those things that are going to disturb one's studies. In other words, one has to learn to be austere. Like that. Brahmachari means austere. Tapasya brahmacharina. So the brahmachari must be austere. Tapasya. So austerity means just basically you control the senses and you respect others. That's the essential point. We see the Gita mentions that austerity of the body is you respecting, you know, the parents, elders, respectable people, cows, you know, spiritualists, like this. That's the main thing of that. Plus keeping the body very clean and celibacy. That these aspects then are very important. So respect of others, cleanliness, and control of the senses. Then of the of the mind. Then is no, the words is next. Then the words is that one speaks according to Shastra. One speaks gently, which was discussed in the previous verses, and with a purpose to benefit someone else, like that. That's austerity of the tongue. And in the mind is that one does not think of all kinds of nonsense, tries to keep the mind very pure, thinks according to Shastra. Also it mentions reciting the Vedic literatures or shlokas, like this is also an austerity of the words. So like this, one keeps oneself. The brahmachari is expected to follow this, so this is austerity. Doesn't mean he has to stand on his head in a bucket of, you know, freezing cold water and things like not like that, or, you know, eat one grain of rice every other day, or it's meaning just that you are able to control the senses, be clean, and respect others with your body, your mind, and your words. That's basically what it boils down to. Because controlling the senses can happen only if you are clean and if you respect others. If you can't respect others, then the arrogance comes up. When the arrogance comes up, the senses become active. Right? And then, illicit sex creates uncleanliness. Right? So they go together. So then all this is all for the same purpose. Being very clean is for controlling the senses. Respecting others is to control the senses. And only when the senses are controlled, we can detach ourselves from the material nature and then attach ourselves to the spiritual nature. We cannot become attached to the spiritual nature. To that degree we detach from the material nature, to that degree we can attach ourselves to the spiritual nature. We can't be 100% attached to material nature and 100% attached to spiritual. It won't happen. You cannot be facing the sun and not seeing your shadow, which is behind you, and fully seeing your shadow and facing the sun. It just, the two don't happen. to that degree that you turn from the shadow, you start to see the light. And as you turn more, then it's part shadow is there, part light is there. As you turn more, then there's more light, less shadow, until eventually you don't see the shadow. So that's why the phrase is used, Bahir Mukh. The face has been Bahir, has been turned away from Krishna. Antar Mukh is then it's turned towards Krishna. Like this. So this is the basic principles. Now, depending upon the time, place, circumstances, these may be applied in different ways. So it's important to understand what's the principle behind the rules so you know how to adjust according to the time, place, and circumstance. Then, 176. Every day having bathed and being purified, you must offer libations of water to the gods, sages, and manes, worship the images of the gods, and place fuel on the sacred fire. So here, after having taken one's bath and been purified by, you know, chanting, how you say, by proper consciousness, by chanting, by achman, then he must offer water to the gods, sages, and manes. Means that when he takes bath, he does tarpana. When he's going to chant his gayatri, he does tarpana. Tarpana means offering of oblations of water to these persons, the gods, the sages, and the manes. So basically we do this by offering to the, if we want to follow that, offering to the previous acharyas, offering to Krishna, like this. We don't worry about forefathers or the previous acharyas, you know. Sages are also the previous acharyas. And then to the gods, we offer to Krishna. Krishna and his, you know, his different forms, his associates, like this. So the same thing is accomplished, but in this way. So that's also done by chanting. Then worship of the deities that we do, and placing fuel in the sacred fire by performing their daily homas they would do. So the yajna then is also by chanting and by doing the gayatri, by reciting the Veda, the Bhagavatam, Gita, and all those benefits are gotten. So by chanting Hare Krishna, worshipping the deities, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, the association of devotees, living in the Dham, you get all the benefits of offering, you know, the libations of water to the gods and performing the sacred, worshipping the sacred fire. Right. So that is accomplished there. So that, in other words, this aspect must be there. The student must be involved in the devotional activities as described by Rupa Goswami, with a purpose of taking part or applying it in the Sankirtan mission in some way or another, small or large. And he must be, and must be clean and pure. That's the essential point. So from there, then you can start understanding the whole study of the brahmachari, the whole curriculum for training the brahmachari. So this is the first point that's being made. This is the general thing. Then it'll get into what he studies, how he studies. But the essential point is his character must be there, right? Residing with the teacher, observing the rules, then controlling the organs for spiritual benefit. So the whole purpose is spiritual benefit. Then in this, now, he's going to be bathed clean, and he's going to be offering worship, you know, to the person, the worshipable personalities. Then, it says here, let him abstain from honey, meat, perfumes, garlands, substances used for flavoring food, women, all substances turned acid, and from doing injury to living entities. So honey creates heat in the body, creates a lot of heat in the body. So in the winter time, then there's not so much problem in taking it, but like in summertime, rainy season, generally it would be avoided for brahmacharis, because it creates a lot of heat in the body. If the body becomes overheated, it creates lust. So generally the brahmacharis will follow whatever will reduce those things. Meat also being the mode of ignorance, then will create a lot of, the senses will become very disturbed. Perfumes, then you only wear perfumes to make yourself smell nice, right? Means, I was thinking about the other day, when you have men with men, then they're always, you know, how tough they are, you know. you know, who's the nastiest, who's the stinkiest, you know, who's looking the most disheveled and rough and ready and all that. But you take all those heavy, rough, stinky, smelly, dirty guys, and you bring one lady in the room, and they all start kind of like, you know, moving their hair a little bit and adjusting their shirt a little bit. And in other words, the men don't worry about what they smell like. You know, the more stinky they are, the more men they are, like that. And but they only worry about these things generally when there's ladies. So that one would wear perfumes generally means one has an inclination in that direction. That's generally the understanding. Plus, then it brings on the bodily concept of life, that the body isn't so bad after all. You know, by wearing perfumes, then you'd also don't have to worry so much about taking baths and this and that. And it was very popular in Europe some centuries back, as they didn't bathe. You know, I heard Queen Elizabeth took two baths in her life. One when she was born and one after she died. So in between, she didn't bother. But they wore perfumes like that. That's why they would go send traders to India, because India had really good perfumes, you know. You didn't get much out of the English countryside, you know, maybe clover or something, clover perfume or something like that. But in India, you had all these very nice, you know, sandalwood and kus and all these different kinds of amazing smells that they would bring back and they would put them on, right? This is the origin of the French bath, right? You go and you wash your face and wash your hands, and then you put on your perfumes, and then everybody can't tell what you smell like, and you yourself can't tell. So the whole point is that the perfumes also then reduce the interest in cleanliness. You know, you already smell great, you think you're fine. But if you don't get into perfumes, then you notice when the body's not clean, and then you make an endeavor to clean it. And by keeping the body clean, it reduces the senses, the agitation. So it's very important for the brahmacharis. Garlands, this would mean on their own. Mahaprasad garlands, that's another thing. But just garlands that are made for themselves, then that's generally avoided. Anything that decorates the body or gives the body, you know, something that's, you think it's wonderful and nice and worshipable. Then things that are very used for flavoring the food means things that are extra, means very strong, like achars and other things that create a lot of, because generally you see these things for flavoring are either hot or sour, right? You don't put flavorings on food that are bitter, right? Anybody ever heard of some nice bitter sauce that they put on their things, right? Or, you know, astringent, you know, it's generally not much goes on that's astringent. You know, so mostly most sauces are hot or sour. I mean, and sometimes they're a little sweet, right? So heat, hot, creates heat in the body, and sour also creates heat. So it mentions here, all substances turned acid, because acid creates heat in the body. Like that, it doesn't cool. We generally think it's cool on the tongue, but after it digests, it creates heat. You know, that's like in the West, it's very common to take vitamin C when you have a cold. It's because it creates heat in the body. Because it's an acid, when you have ascorbic acid, when you take it, it creates heat. So each of the six tastes, when they're eaten, then after digestion they change, and they become something else. I think the only one that doesn't change is the chilies. That's why when you eat them, they go in the east gate hot, and they come out the west gate hot. They maintain their heat. Like that. So, therefore, these flavorings for the food and substances turned sour create heat in the body. You know, like Prabhupada said, that after 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 3 or 4, I think he said 4, don't take yogurt. Four, yeah. One shouldn't take yogurt. Because otherwise, then it has effects on the body, and it increases the heat, increases lust. Like that. And it says, from doing injury to other living creatures. Because when you injure others, then that violence is actually, Prabhupada mentioned once, he was asking, what is the, like, someone I don't know what the discussion, how it came up, but basically it was pointing out that there's a great attraction in the material world for sex, because it's like, how you say, it's like the strongest engagement of the senses. And, I mean, if you want to look at it just bare bones, then it's also one of the highest levels of, how you say, exploitation. But it's just that it's mutual. You know, I exploit your body, you exploit mine, and I don't complain, and you don't complain, and then everybody's happy. But then he pointed out that violence is even more than that. Because violence, see, in sex, you only have partial control over the other person. You know? Because you're controlling them, but they're controlling you. They're exploiting, you're exploiting them, but they're exploiting you at the same time. But in violence, you have complete control over the other person. It's like life or death. So it gives, on the mental platform, an even greater stimulus. You know, sometimes people, when they come back from wars and things like this, very intense, they just can't adjust into the society very easily. Because just the intensity is just not there. They freak out. Or a little thing happens and they just click into that intensity and they, you know, they do strange things. You know? So he Prabhupada was mentioning it's even more. So therefore we see that, you know, the popular thing of you know, most novels and, you know, entertainment, modern entertainment, is sex and violence. Because these are the top levels, and if you can have them both, then it's even better, you know. But at least just settle for one in the same movie, you know. You know, it's like, if there's going to be no sex in the whole movie, then there better be lots of violence. You know, then it balances out. But so these two aspects, so this doing injury to living entities, then is an aspect of that. It's like taking the when you take the desire to enjoy, control and enjoy, to the topmost platform of you know, where it kind of like works pleasantly in the society, it's called sex. And when you take it beyond that, then it turns into violence. That's the next level, because that's so. So, in other words, this is another aspect on how to avoid letting the senses get out of control, is by controlling violence, injury to others. So that's injury with the body, injury with the words, even injury in the mind, like that. That one has to be very careful about that. So this is the thing interesting in the Vedic culture, is that the Kshatriyas, that's one of the areas they have to deal with, is violence. But we see that it's very controlled. Fighting is according to rules, that you fight on someone on an equal platform. He has a weapon, you use a weapon, the same weapon. He doesn't have a weapon, you don't use a weapon. You know, you only fight at certain times of the day. When you're not fighting, then, you know, you behave, you know, as, you know, friends and all that, because it's so for them it's more of a sport. It's not that you want to inflict pain on the other person. That's not the goal. The goal is that the fighting is a challenge, and then whoever wins, I mean, they both win. Whoever wins then enjoys the facilities here on earth. Like if two kings fight, if one wins the battle, he gets the kingdom. And the other one goes to the sun planet. So both win. They both know that. So they don't. To them it doesn't matter which one it is. It's not that they are trying to injure the other person. They're just trying to, in religious warfare, trying to establish, you know, dharma. So if one king feels the other is not protecting his citizens properly, you know, is behaving properly, or is bothering his own citizens where he can't protect them, then he may fight with them. But it's not on the point of violence. So when we, sometimes it's thought someone's very passionate, They yell and scream a lot. They get angry a lot. They tend towards physical violence. Oh, they're Kshatriyas. No, that's the mode of ignorance. They're not. Kshatriyas aren't like that. They don't use their power in such a cheap way. Like that. That's not their position. And if they do use, they're untrained. Like Venu. He was unqualified. Duryodhana. You know, we see Duryodhana. Then he locked up, Shakuni's whole family, whole dynasty, in a dungeon, and then would give enough food for one person. And that's all. So he really wanted to make them feel bad, you know? So then they all got together, the family, and they decided, okay, we're all going to die, but he's giving enough food for one person. So now, one person will eat this food, and they will live. And they will live only for the purpose to revenge the family and to destroy Duryodhana. So then, after discussions and all that, and they saw Shakuni, he was, young, fit, clever. He was more clever than Duryodhana, so he could get in his ear and control him. So he got the food, and the whole family died. And I think it was the eldest, the grandfather, someone said when they die, take the knuckles of his fingers and make those into dice. And then with those dice, there'll be magic dice. Whatever you throw, whatever you want, you throw it, you'll get that number. And that's the dice that Shakuni used for the gambling match with Yudhishthira. So that was the turning point where now he's actually brought it one step closer to destroying Duryodhana. So even though Shakuni, it looks like he was the total enemy of the Pandavas, Krishna told, I think Arjuna, or told the Pandavas that your best ally actually is Shakuni. And they were all thinking, how is this? He's the one that speaks the worst about us. But that's just that he knows that if Duryodhana goes against the Pandavas, who are religious and great devotees, he's finished. He knows dharma. So he knows that if you perform a dharma, then that much quicker you're finished, and to that degree. So his whole point was to encourage Duryodhana in a dharma so he would be totally finished. Like that. So he was not a fool. But we see the point is that Duryodhana was unqualified. He was totally unqualified. A king doesn't do this to somebody. Right? You either fight with them on the battlefield chivalrously, challenge them, or you leave them as vassals and just take tax. You've defeated them, so now if you want tax, they have to pay tax. That's how you control them. Or, if they're not surrendering, you fight until either you win or they win. But this where you just capture them and then put them in a dungeon and let them die starving to death. Then that's, and not only that, insulting, you give food for one person, So it's like very unqualified. Then we see what happened to him. So Shakuni, just follow the thing is, okay, he defeated my family, so now I defeat his, So it wasn't, but whatever, he was following the desire of the family there. So then, and we see, what's his name? Venu. His friends would play with him. He sometimes locked them up in little caves or do things and he'd kill them. Very unqualified. So much so that his father saw that what's the use in his going on as a Kshatriya in the palace. Kshatriyas, then they have something. They run the kingdom. They're supposed to turn the kingdom over to their son. After he's duly trained, so that he can run the kingdom. And so the protection of the people continues. The traditions of the family continue. The people prosper and are happy. They become Krishna conscious. They become economically developed. Everything happens nicely. But when he saw this son is useless, there's nothing like that, so he said, what's the use? So then he himself just went to the forest. As you can see that there's, I cannot do anything in my service. My service ends here. It's finished. like that. So he left because he saw his son was so unqualified. So we see here is that in both cases, you know, or Hiranyaksha, Hiranyakashipu, Ravana, violent, very violent, but also very sensually disturbed, very sensually active. So the two go hand in hand. So if you can reduce violence or not commit any violence, remain clean and be respectful to others, you can control the senses. Otherwise, it's not possible. Therefore, you see that these are practiced in youth as a student, but they are maintained by all the cultured people throughout their life. They maintain these. They're always clean, always respectful, and always stay away from violence. And only the king will use violence if it's necessary in a war. All other aspects, all other avenues have failed. Speaking nicely, giving positions, there's been separating them from, you know, separating the parties and threatening with consequences, and still nothing's happened. Then he must fight. He must use violence. But otherwise, before that, he's tried all other methods. Then other things he should not do is from anointing his body, applying cudgel to the eyes, from the use of shoes, this means leather shoes, and of an umbrella, a parasol, from sensual desire, anger, covetousness, then mundane dancing, singing, and music. So we anoint the body with very nice unguents and different things like that. It makes the body very healthy and strong and all that. So generally the brahmacharis would not do that, just what it takes to keep the body fit. You know, you may put a little bit of mustard oil like this and that to keep the skin proper when it's cold. But otherwise to give very soft skin and nice things, and especially using special oils and mixes and special kinds of powders and all these things which are offered in the Vedic culture that they know how to use, that would be avoided. In other words, just what it takes to keep it body and soul together. Then use of leather shoes. Generally, the leather shoes would be reserved for the grihasthas. That when the brahmachari, after finishing his education, when he would go through the graduation ceremony of Samvartana, at that time, then traditionally, he would put on leather shoes. He would wear a garland. He would put on a dhoti, nice dhoti, you know, like that, and, you know, decorate them. They'd be decorated very nicely, you know. He would shave off his matted locks and go for like this. He would be respected in this way and honored in this way. So here, this does not mean that they would go barefoot or they could use wooden shoes, but they wouldn't generally use the leather shoes like that. Use of an umbrella, because they wouldn't keep an extra umbrella with them. They would have their deer skin. So their deer skin is waterproof, so if it rains, they use that. If it's hot, then they'll put that on their head or put their cloth on their head. In other words, the life would be simple, like that. You know, in present times, since we don't have deer skins, then umbrella could be used. Because they already have a deer skin, they don't need an umbrella. They wouldn't keep both. Then sensual desire, anger, covetedness, that's understood, and mundane dancing, singing, and music, that's naturally understood. Then from gambling, idle disputes, backbiting, and lying, from looking at and touching women, and from hurting others. Yeah, so here, it's mentioned here, injury to living creatures, so this would probably mean. And then here from hurting others, is one is dealing means with humans and one is means with animals and bugs and birds and, you know, whatever else you come across. Let him always sleep alone. Let him never waste his manhood. For he who voluntarily wastes his manhood breaks his vow. Like that. So when sleeping alone, then that is better. A twice-born student who has involuntarily wasted his manly strength during sleep must bathe, worship the sun, and afterwards thrice mutter the Rig verse, which begins, "Again let my strength return to me." Page 181. Verse occurs Taittiriya Aranyaka 130. Not Upanishad. Okay, I don't know the verse. Let him fetch a pot full of water, flowers, cow dung, earth, and kusa grass, as much as may be required by his teacher, and daily go to beg for food. So these are services he should do around the ashram. Is that he should bring water needed for the puja, for drinking, cooking, whatever's needed, flowers for the puja, cow dung for purifying the place, use in the puja, earth that is used also for around the house and that, because generally they would be living in simple facilities, so you always need mud, cow dung for fixing the place and doing the different things. And kusa grass would be used for sitting on and making different things for the puja, the different kurchas and different things that were necessary while performing the puja. So this must be done, and he must daily go to beg food. So here was that he went, and the teacher was not charging anything to the students, because the students would go begging every day. So they go once or twice a day, depending upon the situation either they go, see, once a day they go and collect all these things, then another time they go begging, and generally in the evening time then they do service in the ashram, cleaning and all those things. So then they might, instead of cleaning, they may go begging. Like if there's more need of that, or less people are needed to clean, or you know, whatever, that would be seen. So at minimum collect things necessary for the puja. They would once go begging and once do cleaning. And they might do two times begging if it was necessary. Also doesn't mention here. Yeah, maybe it does later, but he also would bring firewood, collect firewood for the yajna. What's that? Oh, I see. Okay. In other words, menial service that is useful is very important. Very important here. It's very important in his development, because without this, there isn't going to be the development of character that will be able to be used to control the senses. Because we've already established that we're controlling the senses for the purpose of spiritual understanding. Then we're going to attain this by being clean, by respecting others, and not committing violence. Then to back that up, then we're going to follow these different things that by not putting on the body or eating or dressing, that are going to create agitation to the senses. Like that. Now, so that is takes care of those aspects. Then we see here is that, or the general points, and then details are coming here. So now in performing these austerities and that, by following the restrictive rules, then these are part of it, that he will do this menial service. Because from that, then he'll actually get the strength to understand and apply what he learns. Because learning it is the first step. Then you have to know how to apply it, actually apply it, and then get the realization from application. So we are trying to get the realization. So that will only come if this menial service is performed. The senses are controlled. And the senses can be controlled when the menial service is there. Otherwise, very difficult. It doesn't come very easily. A student being pure shall daily bring food from the houses of men who are not deficient in the knowledge of the Veda and in performing sacrifices, and who are famous for following their lawful occupations. So here is that you're also begging from those who follow. As we mentioned, it mentioned that a Brahmin who knows the Veda is good. One who knows how to apply it is better, but better than that is one who follows it. So here we're talking about, and then one on that platform, that third platform, he, with time, if he has good association, can come to the platform of realization, if he's humble. So here, the brahmachari goes out and begs only from those people who are practicing that third platform. He's not going to beg from just anyone, just to get. He'll beg from people who have good qualities and who practice the actual sadhana and the devotional practices. That's where it'll go. And not only that, they're famous for it. It means everybody talks about it, so it's obvious that they follow it. Somebody may be following, no one knows about it. But those who are, it's obvious, then everybody respects them. Someone who's not, you may respect, may not respect, like this.
Like that.
Let him not beg from the relatives of his teacher, nor from his own or his mother's blood relations. But if there are no houses belonging to strangers, let him go to one of those named above, taking the last name first. In other words, you do not take any advantage of the teacher and his family. Like that. Then down from that is from his own, means the father's side. And then down from that is his mother's blood relations, the mother's side of the family. He says, but if there's no, if that's all there is in the village, because sometimes you have a small village that all there is in the village is basically these families. Then you'll beg from them, but you'll start with the mother's side. And then if that's all done, or that, then you'll take from the father's side, then from the teachers, like that. But that's generally a very small place. But you do get like that sometimes. In other words, the student is, the point of begging is to learn humility. And in learning humility, there's the dependence upon on the teacher. So you're going out and begging from virtuous, but persons who are not blood relations of your family or the teacher. And then that is all given to the teacher. So you're dependent upon the teacher. It's a very important element in the Gurukul training, is the dependency of the student on the teacher. When he takes the upanayanam, then at that time the teacher gives him his dress, his thread, his staff, his deerskin. He gets his bowl for begging. So whatever he needs physically is there. Plus he goes begging, that's given to the teacher. The teacher arranges for his cooking, and that's what he eats. And he stays antevas, he stays at the teacher's house. So he's dependent upon the teacher for his residence, for his clothing, and his fooding. Not at all from the house. It's all from there. Then in this way, then there is that dependency also then makes for this, what is mentioned in the Bhagavatam, Narad Muni mentions, this firm friendship. Because that closeness is there. It's like a family. It's called Guru Kula, place of the Guru. It's not just, you know, some place or teacher's place where, you know, you go for a visit and learn some academics and then go back home. No, antevas means that you live there. That is your place. The center of your life is there now. It's not partially in the home and partially there. No, it's totally there. And sometimes for need, begging, things, this, that, maybe comes from the family. But it still is given to the teacher, and you receive it from the teacher. So this is a very important element. We also find that when we're gaining knowledge, we gain knowledge. We gain knowledge from somewhere, we also have to bring that to the teacher and get that back from them. So Rupa Goswami makes the point is you can only approach the previous acharyas through your acharya. So if you get something from one of the other acharyas, you read from Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Jiva Goswami, Sanatana Rupa, like this, you can take that, but you have to run it through how Prabhupada presents it. You have to see it in that light. So this is a very important principle. So for the young student who is not able to understand these fine, higher things, at least he understands the point is that everything I get comes through the teacher. Like that. My place to stay, my clothes, my food. It all comes, whatever I get, I give to him, and it comes back through there. So whatever knowledge I get, then I also, that goes to my acharya, my spiritual master. Then that becomes, that is, that becomes perfect. So it's a very important principle. Plus humility. You go out, they may give, they may not give. So the, yeah. And, but you have to go and, you know, present yourself as just a beggar. It doesn't matter what family they're from, even if they're from the emperor's son, they still go out begging. He has to learn humility. Because in humility, he can control the senses. It's another very important aspect. And you can properly, submissively inquire. Then only can you gain knowledge. And if you're humble, you'll render service. So all this is important. It helps in cleanliness. It develops a subtle cleanliness. So the desire for distinction, adoration, and profit goes. So when that goes, then the gross attachment to sense gratification goes. So you see, it's a very scientific brahmacharya, and the life of the brahmacharya in the gurukula is very scientifically done. It's not just something made up. So those who oppose it basically are uneducated. They don't understand why, its purpose, what it's for. Like this, is Prabhupada says that human life starts with Garbhodan. Cultured society starts with Garbhodan. Then that's where the Manasamhita started. And then from there, someone who's gone through all this, now this is their point of training. They come up and then they're trained under the teacher. Then these are the persons who go on to become the leaders of society. If they remain in the house and are trained in the house, very difficult to become a leader. Because you've never been on your own. How do you, here, the child, he goes out begging. He goes out. He's able to deal with the world. Plus, in the environment, he's dressed as a brahmachari. He's coming for begging. So everybody in the village or town where he's begging knows here is a brahmachari studying in the gurukul. So therefore, no one bothers him. You know, he's respected for that, and he, even though he moves in the world, he's not part of the scene, because he's still a student. He's part of the Gurukul scene. He's not part of the bigger cultural scene. That is for the Grihasthas and those who are living in the house. So he's actually able to go out and see that world without being part of it. So he can be very observant also. He can see how things are going on. So what he's learning from the teacher, learning from the shastras, he can see it going on. He can see the birth, death, old, and age. He can see, you know, the material endeavors and the frustrations and all the different things that people go through. The superficiality of materialistic culture. You know, all that he can see. Because when he goes out, no one's going to deal with him as one of them. They know that the brahmacharya is in another category, so while they're training, you don't bother them. So they're not part of the scene. You don't expect from them what you do from others. Their thing is to study. They become trained. So this way they also get to observe the world, while someone who's living in the house, always very hard to observe the world, because you never think. Right? When you're at the house, you just walk in and you want something to eat, and you know, you go into the, you know, refrigerator or into the pantry, or you know, tell your mother, she gives you something, and you know, you come at the stipulated time and you just sit down and eat and then run off, you know. Mother's gonna, you know, worry about getting it, you know, preparing it, cooking it, you know, serving it, washing the plates, you know, you go into your room, take some stuff off and throw it on the floor in the corner and put something else on and run off. Mother will take care of it all. So you never think. Everything's just so automatic that actually the academic brain might be stimulated if one goes to some academic classes. But actually one's own personality and thought of the world around you, it never gets stimulated. Maybe much later it comes up, but then it's stimulated as issues. You know, some big issue this way or that way. Then only you can stimulate yourself. But just self-thinking, sitting down and observing the material world, it's too passive, too peaceful, and also too deep and scary for someone who actually has to look at themselves. I mean, anartha nivritti means you have to be able to sit down and look at your own heart and figure out what nonsense is in there. And most people aren't very enthusiastic to do that. Because as soon as they figure out what nonsense is in the heart, and there's so much, immediately then, you know, they get all disturbed or want to kill themselves or lament and want everybody to know how bad they are. In other words, they still try to make themselves the center of attention even though they don't have anything worth being the center of attention about. So anartha nivritti means you can look in your heart, see what's wrong, and remove it without hankering or lamenting. Example we just read in Bhagavatam is Ajamil. He just realized what a nonsense he is. So now what should he do? Therefore, the only solution is spiritual life. And so then what should he do? Be determined to take up spiritual life and determined to not engage in any nonsense anymore. So that is the proper result of anartha nivritti. So it's inspiring. But you can only do that if one is humble and able to view. Now, Ajamil was a proper dutiful Brahmin when he was young. So he was trained. He had gone through this. So it was quite easy for him, even though he had a life of nonsense. But he could fall back on that training. Therefore, in the Vedic culture, it was so important that the children were trained in how to actually observe and understand and think. To be inquisitive, why? But to go deeply into it. In other words, why has to be so deep that you connect it to God? Just superficially, no, but you have to go deep enough that it connects to the Supreme Lord. Like that. Otherwise, if the inquisitiveness is not encouraged, or it's just enough to materially gain some knowledge, that's not enough. It must go deep enough that you see God in everything, connected to everything. Then that's proper training, proper understanding. Okay. So all this means the begging is very important for developing this, the begging, the menial service, the collecting useful things for the ashram. Then 185, or if there are no virtuous men of the kind mentioned above, he may go to each house in the village, being pure and remaining silent. But let him avoid... Abhishastas. Abhishastas or Abhirastas? Those accused of moral sin. In other words, those... If you don't have any people who are knowledgeable and practicing the Veda very nicely, then you go to whatever house you can. You can go to each house, but he should be very pure himself and remain silent. In other words, don't talk with him. Or here, silence. For us, silence means don't talk any nonsense. Only talk about Krishna. So then one can go in this way, you know, in this mood, but avoid those who are morally very not good character. You know, if you don't have anyone of positive character, then okay, just average people who are, you know, okay, nice, upstanding citizens. Average people, but don't go to those who are very sinful. We see that sometimes people who their business or their means of collecting money was not clean, was not good. If they gave money to Prabhupada, he would not put it in his own accounts that were used for various projects, for his own, you know, traveling or for use for Mayapur, Vrindavan, and construction like that. He would just take that money and put it in the hundi, the pranami box for Krishna. And it just goes wherever Krishna wants it. He would not use it himself. Because the money carries with it the mentality, reactions of the people. So like when the king takes tax, he gets with him. He takes with that, you know, qualities. When you take food, you take qualities. So when they go begging and they take donations and this, you take some of the qualities. That's why it says first the brahmachari should just go to those who are practicing virtuous men. because then he gets those qualities. If not, you go to average people. Maybe he doesn't gain any good qualities, but he gains no bad qualities. But avoid those who are sinful. Like that. So that's an important aspect. Right? So in other words, even if we do collect from people who are sinful, but that's all Krishna's. It all goes for Krishna. Like that. Then, from Krishna, then we get back. Means that principle of taking, giving to the authorities, giving to Krishna, and then receiving it back from them. Then that's maintained. Like that. After having brought sacred fuel from a distance, okay, it says here, let him place it anywhere but on the ground, and let him, unwearied, make with it burnt oblations to the sacred fire, both evening and morning. Then here he brings sacred fuel from a distance, means if it's very near the place where you live and all that, then it may get contaminated and this and that. So generally they would go into the forest far enough that it is a pure and clean place. In other words, the wood should be from a clean area. The wood should be clean. Then you don't keep it on the ground because this will be offered into the fire. So you want to try to keep it nicely and all that. That is the proper way. So some way it should be stored just so it's off the ground. If it's on the ground, it gets damp, it gets dirty, things get swept on it, people kick it. And when it's in the air, it stays dry and it's away from the moisture. So you don't get all kinds of things growing on it or too many bugs in it. Like this. So then it becomes a nice offering for the fire. And it says, unwearied. And he says, let him unwearied make with it burnt. So the brahmachari should not feel bad about doing, every day I have to do this. He should be enthusiastic every day to perform this. Because as long as he's in the Gurukul, he would be performing this yajna morning and evening. Doing yajna morning and evening, or doing worship morning and evening. Like this, he should not weary of doing these things. If he does, then it's basically one cannot learn a whole lot more. Because if one wearies in these duties, then it makes it very difficult to learn other things very nicely, at least in the way of character. Academics one can learn, because that's just a matter of memorizing. Basically, modern academics means simply you memorize till you have a vast body of knowledge. No university in the world expects you to have realization on the knowledge you have. There's not one anywhere. So you just have to have a good memory and a good way to deal with that knowledge. You can connect this with this and this and that. So you have some discrimination. But actual realization and application, just like you may be expert, let's say, in the life of ancient Egypt, but no one expects you to live like that or have those values or have that philosophy. Just you know it. In other words, you've memorized a great vast body of knowledge and you can connect it together in very interesting ways. And in this way, give nice lectures and make nice presentations and different things. But no one's expecting you to live like that. But the Vedic knowledge is you study the Vedics and you study the histories and you're expected to practice it. So you must practice what your body of knowledge. You know astrology, you're expected to practice it. You know Sanskrit, you're expected to practice it. You know the philosophy, you're expected to practice it. So it's a different aspect. So if you're weary of these things, then it makes it very difficult for you to actually come to the point of realization. You can gain more academic knowledge, but realization and application, because you don't want to apply it, And until you come to that stage of application, you cannot realize. Right? You cannot realize. So we see here in the whole thrust of the Vedic education is this nididhyasana, or realization. Shravana, you hear. Right? So that's the first thing. You get the Vedic knowledge. So I mentioned that's the first step. Then the second step is two parts. You know how to apply it, and then you practice applying it. That's manana. So manana is not just thinking it, but following it. The lower level is just you think about it. The higher level of manana is that you practice it. Then you come to the level of nididhyasana, where you realize. So then it works very, very nicely. So if you are unwearied in doing these services, then to that degree you can go on deeper and deeper and gaining more and more realization. If you weary easily, then you're not going to be able to go deeper, not going to be able to go farther. So much emphasis is put on the menial service and doing these aspects of sadhana. Menial service and sadhana is very much emphasized for the brahmacharya, because then they can go very deep in their studies. They can become deeply realized. Otherwise, then it's very difficult to go very deep. Then, he without being sick neglects during 7 successive days to go out begging and to offer fuel in the sacred fire shall perform the penance of avikirnan, one who has broken his vow. So it means if one is not sick, you know, so one is inconvenienced that he can't perform his duties, and one is perfectly healthy, and one doesn't do it, then he actually breaks his vow of brahmacharya. So then the atonement here, then they do this particular penance. Mention anything here? So, yeah. In other words, he should not be lazy. He should always be very active. If he becomes lazy, then it's not good. He will not be a good student. So the Vedic culture is always trying to develop the best of the students. It was the opposite of in the animal kingdom, survival of the fittest means whoever was physically, you know, developed, then they survived the onslaught of the material nature. You know, they could run fast enough to get away from something chasing them, or like this, you know, if the two of them got together, you were stronger, then you defeated the other one, like this. But here, then it's the actual development of those who prosper in the society are those who are actually well-trained in the culture, in the knowledge, practicing the knowledge. They became the leaders of the society. So if he can't, he gets, you know, doesn't want to do begging or can't do perform his yagyas or his other vows of, you know, going out and collecting this and that, he becomes lazy, then he's not going to actually be able to lead the society as a good Brahmin, as a king. He may be able to motivate himself doing business or something that creates economic development. Like that, he may be able to push on because he gets the fruit. But out of duty, it'll be very difficult for him to do. So he may be a businessman, but he'll be weak in his sadhana and other things. Or he may be able to pursue his art, you know, his field is. Because then, you know, the mental and sensual satisfaction from it. But it'll be very difficult. He won't be able to lead. So the whole Vedic civilization is to train those who can lead. Either the whole society or a community, or a family, or at least oneself. But if one can't do that, then it's not recommended. He who performs the vow of studentship shall constantly subsist in alms. but not eat the food of one person only. The subsistence of a student on begging food is declared to be equal in merit to fasting. So we were discussing before about doing, you know, heavy austerities. So, you know, fasting is considered a strong austerity, like Hiranyakashipu or Dhruva Maharaj, you know, gave up. He was eating only leaves off the, I think, the banyan tree, or these little fruits, little red fruits. And then he gave that up and was only taking water. Then after another month, and he gave that up and he was only breathing air. And then after another month, he gave that up and he stopped breathing. And then the whole universe couldn't breathe. So then they decided his austerities were enough. So then, you know, the Lord came and gave him benediction. So fasting is considered a strong austerity. So by begging, if you live by begging, then and living off of what the teacher gives you, that's considered fasting. Like that. So therefore it's a very important thing for the brahmachari that even he gets things. You know, let's say something comes, somebody gives him something, that has to be shared. The normal thing, the brahmachari, would be he would beg and that would be given to the teacher. That would be what was cooked. Whatever the other students also begged, that was all put together, that was cooked, and that's the meals that they ate. But otherwise, you know, in a modern scenario, sometimes parents give something, this and that. If they share it with everybody else under the, how you say, permission of the teacher, then that's still considered fasting. The austerity, the benefit you get from fasting, one still gets that benefit. But one takes that and considers, this is mine. My parents gave this, it's mine. And eats it himself or shares it with one or two of his close friends, but not with the others. He has broken his fast. The austerity, the vow of brahmacharya is actually, in a mild way, but it's broken. Because now he's not dependent upon the teacher. He's not dependent upon begging. Like this. And here it also says you shouldn't take food from one person only. It should always change. So that's why generally they would go to different houses every day. Like that. So they would be, you know, they'd be careful on that, that you don't become dependent upon one person, because the brahmachari means he's not dependent. The Brahman, the Kshatriya, the Vaishya are not dependent. They're dependent upon the Lord, of course, but they are independent in their occupation. So if you're dependent upon one person, then you're not independent. So like that, you should not get everything from one place. It should be from a few places. Like that. At his pleasure, he may eat, when invited, the food of one man at a rite in honor of the gods, observing, however, the conditions of his vow, or at a funeral meal in honor of the manes, behaving, however, like a hermit. So this means is that sometimes the brahmacharis would be invited to eat it at people's houses, like that. So that can be done. That there's something done for some ceremony for the Lord, some nice somebody's doing like that. But he must observe the conditions of his vow. Means he has to still behave as a brahmachari, still live, dress, act. He also has to eat according to his vow. Like that. And just deal. You know, it's not that when he's in the ashram, then, you know, he doesn't talk to the girls or doesn't laugh and joke and do all these things. But now when he goes to these houses, then he's, you know, checking everybody out and eating whatever he can get his hands on and not cleaning himself properly. Like we read before, that a cultured person will always clean his hands, mouth, feet before he eats, also after he eats these things. He won't give these things up. He'll follow his lifestyle. In other words, as a brahmachari, there's a lifestyle. Many times we see in the Gurukul, the kids have a tendency to think that the lifestyle they live and the standards are only for the school. When they go home, they don't have to follow it. Or they go to someone else's house, or go out on a program, they don't have to follow it. No, the vow of brahmacharya is there. It doesn't matter the situation. That remains. It's a very serious thing. many times as Westerners or, you know, just modern man doesn't understand the seriousness of these things. We see that, like when Prabhupada in 1970, then there was a group, there were four sannyasis who somehow or another had an idea that Prabhupada was God, you know, and that's why he left, you know, and went, and he was upset because no one understood he was God. And, you know, how you say, he went to India, he wasn't coming back, and oh, they preached and disturbed the devotees very much. When Prabhupada heard about it, he said, just send them out. You know, they can't stay in our temples. So then, but we see, you know, and they said, well, what should they do? And he says, well, they're sannyasis. They can go out and beg, preach, do whatever they want, but not around here. So Prabhupada didn't say, okay, now you're not with us, so that's it. Now you just, you know, go home with the mommy and put on your, you know, put on your pants again and, you know, just go work at McDonald's or whatever you like. No, he said, you're sannyasis. So the ashram remained, even though they weren't accepted as members of ISKCON. They had to leave. But the ashram remained. So it's a serious thing. So someone's a brahmachari, all situations he's a brahmachari. Someone's a grihastha, all situations he's a grihastha. Vanaprastha, sannyas. In all situations it has to be maintained. It's not just an easy thing, someone doesn't behave properly. Oh, I'll put him in this, do that with them, or step down from sannyas, or, you know, do this or that. No. It doesn't work like that. These ashrams are serious. So whatever the situation, that's to be maintained. There's a dress code. There's just something there that must be followed. So here the brahmachari, when he goes out, he shouldn't think that because he's not in the gurukul, therefore he doesn't have to follow the rules of the gurukul. No. As long as he's a brahmachari, he has to follow. Those rules are there. So whatever the rules that are stipulated, that must maintain. So this is the principle behind it. So whatever is established as the rules, that must be maintained. How he dresses, how he behaves. Says he can also go to a shraddha, when, you know, after someone's died, then they always feed so many brahmins or brahmacharis or devotees or like that. He can go to that. But he must behave also, here it says, as a hermit. In other words, very simple, stay out of the way, just come, do, go. You know, he can preach, but he can't just get into frivolous talk and just, you know, kick back and all that kind of thing. He must always remember his vow, because then that will give him his determination in life. Otherwise, if one may say, well, this seems, you know, a little harsh, but then let's say someone is a king, someone is a manager, then he always has to be remembering the citizens. He may have some time to himself, you know. But that is so that his mind becomes relaxed, so he can better serve the kingdom, serve the citizens. The king's mind is always so tense from so many disturbances and anxieties and management during crises during the day. Then the next day he'll be less fit. So therefore, in the evening they all work stops, you know, and then they spend the time, you know, just being with family members, studying the shastras, talking with the brahmins, hearing music, you know, different things like that, dramas, something that will relieve the mind, you know, and give it some freshness. So the next day he's fit for managing the kingdom again. But he can never forget and think, yes, just this is my time, I'm a sense enjoyer. Otherwise he won't be a good king. Same like a businessman, he's always thinking of his business. Even when he's not doing business, he's thinking how to best develop the business. And the Brahmin has to be thinking about his knowledge, how to apply it, his service, like that. An artist has to be thinking of his art. Otherwise he doesn't become expert. So now if the brahmachari can't maintain his vows of brahmacharya and behave as a brahmachari, I can't remember that long to, you know, while he goes to somebody's house and maintain it for some time. He's not going to become expert in anything in the material world. Like that. At least not without motivation. With motivation, he may become expert. But the whole process of Krishna consciousness is to act dutifully without motivation. So one has to be able to maintain the vows. It's not that it's on for so many hours and then off for so many hours, or on for so many months and off for so many months or time. There's no vacation from being a brahmachari. There may be maybe pleasant times, but the vows must remain. And that must always remain. Okay, are there any questions on this? Because now it goes a slightly different direction.
Can I ask a couple of questions that's occurred to me while staying in my food? When you talked about what creates heat within the body.
Yes.
And I've experienced the devotee's prasada, which is full of chili. And two things occurred to me. One, that it's in the mode of passion, theoretically, but also it's food that's offered. What I'd like to know is, is such food accepted as offering? Because it is prasadam, as I understand it.
Mm.
You know, but I'm confused by that. Perhaps you could enlighten me somehow.
If there's two things there. One, chili is used to balance ghee or oil. Means oil digests, that there's something to balance it. So you have to have something hot. Means pungent is one of the six tastes. It just should not be overly done. So without the pungent, so some ginger, some chili, something has to be there that will cut the oil. So the more rich it is, generally the more chili must be there. Then, so the trick is to balance it so that it's not hot. Then the other aspect is, if one is not used to taking anything pungent at all, then what may not actually be so hot, you may find hot. You know, just like India itself, generally in the West, it's considered India is very hot. If you live in India, then you find that the rest of the world is actually cold. You know, it's just a matter of how you look at it. You know, it's like I was the temple president from... Radhadesh was here, and I was joking with him that the weather that's here now is the weather that was there when I was there last summer. So I was joking with him that our winter is their summer, you know, because he was saying, yeah, it's very nice, pleasant weather, and we're thinking, wow, this is cold. But he was saying, yeah, it's very pleasant, very nice. You know, to him it was like summertime. You know, you just see him walking around in his kurta, and, you know, he doesn't feel cold, and it's summer. Mm-hmm. So like that, there may be a little bit of adjustment. So it's would be, you'd have to see from those who, you know, live here and all that, if they feel it's hot. If they're saying it's hot, then it's too hot. You know, but that you'd have to, it's very individual. And these things, you can talk to the pujaris, because they'll have more of an idea.
The other one was where you said reading of literatures from other acharyas, but really doing it through your spiritual master, you know, so you can inquire through it. This comes through like the ISKCON process, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm reading it for my personal enlightenment while I'm here, and that sort of thing. What is the situation with that?
Means that we have to see it in light of what Srila Prabhupada teaches in his books. That's the thing, is that in other words, with that view, we look at it. You know? It's just like, let's say, someone who's trained in architecture, engineering, then when they go out, and the tendency will naturally be, when they look at any building, they're going to look at it and interpret it according to their particular training in engineering or architecture. on whether it's, you know, applicable, that something that they would use or not. You know? So in the same way is that what we read, then we have to see, is this, you know, does it come in line with the presentation how Prabhupada would give, how he would apply it, and how we'll use it, and how to use it in our life, and then see it from that light, like that. So it's therefore one needs to know also the teachings of our own acharya. Then it makes it very easy to then add to our understanding of our own acharya by reading the previous acharyas. But otherwise, one has to already have some training, you know, or best is, you know, deep training. Because whatever is in the acharya's books is in Prabhupada's books. There's nothing that's not there. It just, Prabhupada doesn't necessarily, how you say, overtly use technical terminologies in that. Because technical terminologies will generally put the vast majority of people to sleep, or they lose their interest. So he'll say it in a very pleasant way, very attractive way, but he's saying all the technicalities. So sometimes to understand those technicalities by reading these other books, you start to appreciate how much depth and everything is in Prabhupada's books. But you have to be able to see it from how Prabhupada presents it, like that. Then you actually understand the acharyas, like that. Because Prabhupada knows the acharyas, so therefore he has written what they have given. So if we see a contradiction between what Prabhupada says and the acharyas, then one should know it, that there is no contradiction, because Prabhupada is saying what the acharya is saying, but applying it to us. So if one sees contradiction, then better one doesn't read. If one doesn't see, one can see what they're saying through how Prabhupada is presenting it, then there's not a problem.
It gives me an appreciation.
Yeah. Like when we're going through this book here, we're going through Manasamhita, but we see that all the points that are being made here, Prabhupada makes the points. The principles are all there, and even much of the detail is all there. And some of the detail doesn't necessarily apply. Like we'll use umbrellas, you know, because we don't use deerskins. We have a deerskin, we don't need an umbrella. So a brahmachari shouldn't over-collect. He shouldn't keep both. Right? So the grihastha doesn't use the deer skin. So he uses an umbrella. But nowadays, we don't have the deer skins. You know, and if we had one, it might be looked upon quite strangely, or the police might pick you up that they think you're trading in, you know, rare animal skins or something. So therefore, you know, it doesn't really apply to the situation now. Point is the brahmachari doesn't over-collect. He doesn't keep two things to do one purpose. And he doesn't, he keeps things as simple as possible. Like that. So these points Prabhupada has given. Most of the things are there. Some of the little details due to the situation now don't apply, the detail, but the principle still remains. Like that. Continue, you had something?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
We discussed a lot about the vows of the brahmachari.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there any formal ceremony with the brahmachari takes his vows?
Yeah, that's the Upanayanam ceremony.
So he has to, like, declare his following?
Yeah, the teacher will go through and ask him all the different things. You know, he says you'll do achman. You know, right there it says take bath and purify himself. So he'll do achman. He'll put wood on the sacred fire, means he'll always perform menial service and those kind of duties, you know, that he will, you know, not sleep in the daytime, means he won't waste his time in the day, he'll sleep at night, daytime he'll do service, like that, because sleeping in the daytime also increases heat and lust in the body. So generally the brahmachari would avoid. In the summertime, when it's very hot, little time after lunch, then it's not bad. But generally the rest of the year, it's not recommended. You know, especially in the winter, sleep in the day is you don't get much out of it like that. If one's not well, sick is another thing, but if one is healthy and one's a little tired, it's better to take rest early than that. So these kind of things are there, and R1 it goes through those. But we were reading the other day, I think the Yajurveda one or the Rig Veda goes through many more of the vows. You know, they just say them at the time of Upanayanam. They just go right through them. The teacher just asks, you'll do this? And he says, yes. You'll do this? He says, yes. And then after that, then he... I think at that time, then he starts giving him the danda and the deer skins and the cloth and the thread and the mantras and all that kind of stuff. You know, but first he takes the vows. So that's why before they would go through this ceremony, then join the Gurukul. So either they would do the Upanayanam ceremony somewhere else and then come and join a Gurukul, or they would take Upanayanam from the teacher at the school where they were going to study and then start. Like Krishna took Upanayanam from Garga Muni, but he studied under Sandipani Muni. So like that then. So that would be the tradition. And then they would do again when they turn 16, because this they've done when they're young. And basically they're following because of association. That up to the age of 16, you'll find the students do something because others are doing it. They like the people. The people interest them. They encourage them. So they do what they do. Like that. But at 16, they're an adult. And then at that age, they have to decide for themselves, do they want to do it? It has to be now their own commitment that they're doing it, not just because everybody else does it. Right? Everybody else does it is for younger people. That you do it because you want to do it, that's for somebody 16 and above. So then they do again the haircutting ceremony, the Chudakarmana. But this time, instead of shaving the head, they shave the face. When they were young, they shaved off the hair that was there from when they were born, you know, at the first year, third year, fifth year, and that for their own purification and that. So now it's that they do it again, because now by this age, by 16, there's always, you know, some fuzz on the face. So they shave that, and then that is they take then they like retake their brahmacharya vow or reconfirm their vows of brahmacharya. That this is, you know, that they're going to continue like this. Generally, that would be specifically the Brahmins, because the Kshatriyas used to, at that age, graduate. Kshatriyas, Vaishyas. The Vaishyas would go home and learn the business. Kshatriyas would go home and learn the martial arts and all the, you know, big economics and politics, you know, hands-on stuff they would learn. The Brahmins would continue. So specifically, the Brahmins would do this, reconfirm the vows of Brahmacharya, because the Kshatriyas and Vaishyas would go home and get married at that time. But the Brahmin would stay on longer and study more, go more deeply, like that. So, yeah. So they would redo at that time. They would retake. You know, it's not retake. They're already doing it, but now it means they confirm that I understand now what I'm doing, and I'm doing it because I want to do it. I value it. Like that. So these were the traditions in the traditional Gurukul setup. Is that there would be conscious understanding of what one was doing. Does that make any sense? Yeah.
You mentioned how sense control was important for leadership, personal leadership, and family, and community, so on and so forth. But I didn't mention so much how sense control goes with leadership in those areas.
Ah, how does it? Because, means that if you...
How it connects, the connection.
Yeah. If you want to lead, you have to control your own desires, your own senses. Means your desires are very much in connection with your senses. So it's like, let us say, okay, you have a businessman. He promises you something. Now, let's say he says, yeah, I'll give you this for this price. You come back tomorrow, you know? You strike a deal. you come back tomorrow. Now he's had 24 hours to think about it, and he's just figured out that actually he's going to not make a good profit on this, because he found out some more stuff than he knew. He gave you for one price, and he found out actually his stock price was something else. So instead of making, 100%, he's going to make 10%. And it's a large amount, he could have sold that retail and got a lot more. Or someone else comes along and offers a better price for the same thing. Now, when you come back the next day, he'll make some excuse and not give it to you. Because his senses are in control. He has that desire for the fruit. Therefore, he won't maintain his word. Now, you move to the next level, the king. He gives his word, even if it means he loses everything, he will keep that word. That's his honor. So to do that, you must have controlled senses. You must have much more controlled senses. Right? And like that. And then the Brahmin, he advises the king. The king thinks, I'm doing, yes. I've made my word, I give. But the Brahmin, he understands it's not me. It's the modes of nature that are carrying it out. I know something, but by Krishna's grace, he is knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. I understood it, I have the knowledge, I remember it, that I'm able to speak it and influence somebody else. Krishna's doing that through the modes of nature. So he has to be much more detached, and much more controlled in the senses. He tells the king, this is the best way to do it. And then he has to leave it at that point. The king does it, doesn't do it. It's up to them. Like that. So that takes much more control of the senses. Otherwise, the king is, I've said it, you have to do it. Why you ask me if you're not going to follow it? Brahman is, you ask me my advice, I know it, you're a qualified person, I tell you. You do with it as you want. So it takes much more. And even, so as you move in these, even to do business, it takes control of the senses. You have invested money, you make some profit, now you can just go and spend that. But then the business will collapse. You have to reinvest. So it takes control of the senses. You find these big, fat, Marwari businessmen, they don't eat necessarily lavishly. They eat very simply, dress simply, live simply. Everything is just into the business. The guy's a millionaire, but he lives real. He lives in a hole in the wall. And you would never know this guy's a millionaire. Because his senses are controlled. Nowadays, their senses aren't controlled, and they're losing it. They're spending the money and, trying new things, gambling, trying to get quick money, losing, like this. It's turning, the whole thing's turning into a mess. Because they're not controlling the senses. Culture, the business culture is being lost. If you want to get far in art, let's say you want to become a good musician, minimum you have to put in 6 hours a day. And if you want to become the best, you got to put in 10, 12, 14, 16 hours a day. Like that. So that takes controlled senses. You just got to sit down and practice your music. So unless there's control, to that degree you can control the senses, to that degree you can excel in whatever is your area of knowledge, influence, wealth, or art. It's very, very natural, like that. Does that make some sense?
Just so one on that. Say we have students in the group who want to pursue leadership or arts and management, and then you try to explain to them. How would you explain to them control of their senses will actually help them in becoming a strong leader, a strong manager?
It means if you want to lead somebody, then you're expecting them to be disciplined. So you can't get them to be disciplined if you're not disciplined. You can't get someone to do something you can't do. Right? It means very easily someone who can do something can get someone else to do it. Just like we see, an example would be Napoleon. Now, Napoleon, he would do things. He had no problem getting down and do whatever the men had to do. But if the man can do it, he can do other things. But he has no problem in doing what they're going to do. You know, but since they're there, he can do, you know, bigger organization. You know, or you have Alexander. He would, whatever the facilities were for the men, that's the facilities he would accept. He wouldn't accept different. So therefore, people will follow such a person. Because their senses are controlled. Otherwise, if they just try to get whatever they can, you see that so much now in modern, you know, the modern, you know, politics. You know, it's just your leaders are just out getting what they can out of it in the way of position and facilities and money and fame or whatever. And people aren't inspired to follow. Like it's very interesting that someone's pointing out, when you take America, you know, America is kind of like founded on, I mean, at least the present culture that's being practiced is founded on, you know, the free individual enjoying his senses and living the way he likes. And practically anything goes. But it's almost practically down to, you know, the majority, the people, they expect their leaders to be very pure. You know, very moral and upstanding and properly behaved and no nonsense. Though the whole culture is just sense gratification. So it's a very interesting thing. Because in the Vedic culture, it was like that. It means, what was his name? Shalya? Is it Shalya? Shalya, Sakuni, Gandhari. They're all from Gandhar, that side, Afghanistan. So I think they were, I think it even came out in the thing. That was one of the things that they were ribing each other about. You know, the Yadus started bothering each other about, is that coming from Gandhar. The people are very sinful on that side. They're addicted to sinful activities. So the king takes on part of the sin of the people because of the tax. So they were, you know, it's considered the kings from those areas are more sinful than the ones that say in Aryadesh, whose people are not like that. So, but the point is that we see is the people may be sinful, but the king himself is not. The king follows the rules of the monarchy, of the royalty. So they're pure, and people can look up to that. Well, if the king's just another debauchee like them, it's not very inspiring. So the leader always is at least should be in some way some quality more than the other, and quality comes from control of the senses. As long as the senses are controlled, one can progress, one can develop. When the senses go, it's very hard. You get distracted. You get distracted by the senses. So if one wants to study or develop, then one has to have controlled senses. And if one gets in a position of leadership when senses aren't controlled, then others will consider that exploitation is going on because you're interested in your senses. So because you lead them or control them, therefore you're taking your whatever from senses from them. And that won't be seen nicely by them. Well, if they see that your senses are controlled and nice, then they'll feel inspired to do their service, their work. Like that. So it's all connected. Like that. The more controlled the senses, the higher up one is. That's why the Brahmins are more respected, because they're more detached. That's why the sannyasis, in the ashrams, sannyasis is more respected, because it's more detached. Or in the varnas, the Brahmin is more respected, because it's detached. Right? One may say, well, the king doesn't seem to be, but the king, he only keeps that facility as long as he's the king. As soon as the son or someone else takes up the management, he walks out clean. I mean, with nothing. Whatever's there in the royal treasury or army or anything, he walks out without any of it. He just walks out with some tree bark. Right? So he's expected to take vanaprast in that severity. Right? while, and he went through the whole brahmachari training before he became the king. So he was austere before. When he's sitting on the throne, then he has all royal facilities. But as soon as the next person in line is there to take up, he leaves with nothing. You know, he doesn't siphon anything off to a Swiss bank account or anything like that. While a Vaishya, they may stay in the family and may not go away. It's recommended they do. But if they don't, then, it's hard to get away from the business and stuff. So they're not as controlled in the census. You know, it may look like the king is more, but actually it's not. Just kings are extremists, that's all. Totally into or totally out of it. You know, they're not like that. A Vaishya is very steady. Does that make any sense? Okay, so we'll end here, and then today's what? Wednesday, yes. So we'll continue tomorrow with the activities of the brahmachari. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.